Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. When a student first enters college, he or she begins an advanced liberal learning and in-depth study of a field. We call it the major. What happens when a student's personal faith commitments collide with that of the professor or with their peers or even with the objective course material itself? Or what if the material is so congruent with their commitments that they don't bother to think critically about it? These are some questions that Norman Adler, professor at Yeshiva University in New York, will be tackling in one of his lectures tomorrow at Utah State University. This is a couple of lectures sponsored by Religious Studies Program at USU and the USU College of Humanities and Social Sciences. What happens if big questions and colleges collide? It's the first lecture, and that's happening on the USU campus, 11:30 a.m., Library Room 101. That's tomorrow. Also tomorrow evening, Are We Wired to Believe? A biopsychologist looks at God, the brain, religion, and science. Again, that's Dr. Adler, who is a biopsychologist, and that one is tomorrow evening, 7 p.m. And so we bring in from Yeshiva University, University Professor of Psychology, Norman Adler. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be there in cyberspace and talk with you and my friend Norm Jones. And I guess since we're talking about religion, we can debate whether I'm there or not, since I'm physically not there.
That's right. Exactly. We'll get into that as we go along. As Professor Adler mentioned, Norm Jones is with us, a professor of history. And also you work with, remind me your position, you work with curriculum.
Well, I'm currently Director of General Education and Curricular Integration, but of course I was previously the head of the History Department and the founding Director of Religious Studies.
I'd forgotten that part of it, mm-hmm. The founding Director of Religious Studies. So we welcome in Professor Jones as well. Let's jump into this question, what happens if big questions in college collide, Professor Adler? You are well positioned to take a look at this question. You teach the big questions as a part of the sciences, but you teach at a university which is associated with Orthodox Judaism.
Correct. And our students, and I've taught at many universities. This one is a secular university, but it's under Orthodox auspices. Maybe like Brigham Young. But I've taught at public universities, private universities as well. It's always interesting to see the different reactions that different students have to the material. Either if I teach psychology and religion, or I teach in neuropsychology, which is the background from which I came.
Mm. So the students that you encounter, and I'll ask Professor Jones this question as well, I think national studies have shown many students are spiritual, at least, and many are religious. And so they'd be coming in and encountering some of these big questions.
Yep.
And there'd be many different reactions from those students to these big questions.
You're asking me, Norm Adler?
Yes, first.
Okay,
yes.
Then first. That's the interesting point, and that's why Norm Jones. Norm, we're not going to change our names today. I guess it'll be just
right.
Norm Jones and Norm Adler. The strange phenomenon culturally is that America, on the one hand, is probably the most religious country in the world. Europe is post-religious, but even here, there's been a shift into post-denominationalism, where everybody can sort of pick and choose their own religion. And I think the fastest growing religion now is non-denominational. The extreme version of that is where everybody has his or her own personal religion. Robert Bellow, the sociologist, described this religion called Sheilaism, where there was a woman, I think in the 60s, named Sheila Larson, who developed her own religion. She made up the rules and had her own codified set of beliefs. That's the extreme. But nonetheless, 80% of students in almost every poll come into college searching for something, feel themselves to be spiritual. And tomorrow, if I can, I'm going to bring a couple of standard psychological tests to the students and faculty, if they're willing to take it, to test their religiosity. And I'll get into that later if you want to talk about it. Mm. But they often come to campus where they will meet either, I guess I could say it, the faculty at many universities are post-religious. I've had a breakfast for many years at AACU, and Norm Jones is my co-worker and friend and colleague, where, I don't want to put aspersions on the academy, but let's say that the modern university is not as sympathetic, is not as sympathetic to religion as it was 200 years ago.
We're post-Enlightenment, yeah.
Yeah, we're post-Enlightenment. I'm trying to say it so that if I get quoted, I won't get slammed. Is that fair, Norm?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're post-Enlightenment. So when, at, for example, at Harvard, which is, to some extent, you know, the bellwether, proposed a new curriculum a number of years ago, there was proposed a requirement in faith and reason, because religion should be studied as a objective subject. And it was voted out, as I recall. That was the subject of one of our breakfast meetings, mm-hmm. because a major figure on the Harvard faculty, somebody I know and respect a great deal, said, well, there's too much faith and not enough reason, so let's can it. Mm-hmm. And so on. So the typical paradigm is a student comes in with a belief system, and gets an education which presents certainly post-Enlightenment thinkers, but even going back to ancient history, we'll read Epicurus, Plato, with different systems, and is shocked. Or you'll get a very religious student, or you'll get the opposite. You can get a secular student who gets awakened to something and looks on campus for a faith structure and is either encouraged or not encouraged, depending on who is around. So...
Let me turn to Professor Jones here. This, when we talk about the big questions, and Professor Adler has outlined this, mm-hmm. we are talking about faith versus reason, right? Science versus religion.
In some aspects, yes. Although I think it's often much more subtle than that, because when the student doesn't necessarily feel it as that versus so much as almost like a personal journey, and they encounter things in that journey that will provoke them one way or another. So it's not that they have to choose between faith and reason. It's simply that the whole educational process is teaching them to think in new ways, and part of that is very challenging, no matter where they're coming from. I agree with Norm Adler that the secularist is often just as challenged as the true believer when it comes to things that confront them in the classroom. Mm. New ideas.
Yes, new ideas. Those new ideas, I'll turn to Professor Adler for this, that can be seen as threatening. I assume parents sending their students off to yeshiva, or parents sending their students off to USU, if they've raised their child in a specific belief system, might find those new questions threatening.
Oh, absolutely. From either direction. I teach in an Orthodox university, and my psych and religion course I'm very happy with, and I have the students write the same paper three times. I say it's easy to cheat. Just copy the same paper three times. Over, and the topic is, what is religion? They never cheat. It changes during the semester. And these are kids who have been raised in the tradition over time. And the fourth paper is, don't write a new paper. Analyze how you've changed during the semester. It's one of the most interesting assignments I've ever assigned, because it changes when they get new ideas. Now, they trust me. I've been here for a while, and I'm an Orthodox Jew myself, so I can do things that somebody, a quote-unquote outsider, can't do. And I think Norm Jones talked about being the outsiders to the, you know, a large number of the Mormon students, that you, if you treat things sympathetically and student-oriented, then they will listen. But if you come in with a hostile attitude, it will turn them off to the teacher and to the material. And it doesn't matter which side.
Do you find that, Professor Jones?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things I do when I teach the history of Christianity is I always start with a lecture on the religious pain threshold that students will find at various points in a class like that no matter what their background is, they'll become very uncomfortable. And if you can't deal with your own religious pain threshold, then you may have trouble dealing with the class. But I will, I'm totally open to any of their questions. But often the questions from student A disturb student B. So we really have to set up rules about how we're going to deal with these issues in the class.
That's interesting. What's painful for one student is not painful for another. Mm-hmm. I remember when I teach mythology, because the concept of myth is sometimes not foreign, but nobody ever thinks that your own story is a myth. And I tell them that myth is a very potent idea. And I said, how do you define myth? And one student said, a myth is something that is truer than true. Another guy in the class who was very rational, scientific, says, I won't repeat on the air what he said, but he said, that's nonsense. Something is either true or false, thinking of logic tables. But we confront them. God, I'm thinking this is on the air. Well, we are fundamentalists in the sense that we accept the Bible, the Torah, the what you call the Old Testament. We prefer to call it the Jewish Bible, from God, directly from through Moses. But we know that it was redacted. Mm-hmm. And we have scholars who, for example, take the beginning of Exodus, where it says the Spirit of God rested on the firmament, and the firmament in Hebrew is Tahom. It means sort of chaos, and it turns out that there was a Babylonian deity named Tiamat, and they have an epic called the Enuma Elish, and the kids read it, and they read it in our Bible class. Now, some can't handle it, and some rabbis don't like it, but this nasty goddess who eats her children is finally taken off, kicked off by her kids, and there are parallels to our Holy Bible, and your Bible too.
Mm-hmm. So those uncomfortable questions that usually coming from the other students that Professor Jones
talked
about.
Well, sometimes we ask them too.
Sometimes you as well. And there are faculty members who would be asking some of these questions. To what extent is that good for a student coming in, and when does that cross the line, at least in terms of maybe it goes into proselytizing for a professor's belief?
Mm-hmm. When does it cross the line? That's interesting. I think when it involves harassment, but the line between harassment and academic freedom or your educational goal is a murky one. Norm, do you have any? I don't think I can give a definition.
Yeah. Well,
it's like
I think,
pornography. I know it when I see it.
Yeah. Well, it is a murky one because, of course, we're back to the way the student perceives. Because we as professors, of course, are guided by the values of our disciplines. There are certain things the students have to know and understand and be able to do if they're going to succeed. So you're concentrating on those things. But at the same time, you as a student may feel that concentration is driving you in a direction that you really don't want to go. Your story, Norm, about the the epic of that your students have to read in Bible class, with History of Christianity, start out by explaining that anyone who believes in a church that believes they're restoring the primitive church probably is right because there are so many different versions of the primitive church. You know, that's a very fundamental issue about the historical record that they have to understand. And if they are not willing to take that on, then I can't do my job. Mm-hmm. And they may have to make a decision.
That's interesting. That's interesting because I know a bit. I'm not a theologian, but I know a little bit about the history of Christianity, mm-hmm. and I can see modern forms of Christianity that correspond to ancient heresies.
Oh yes,
and they have nice churches now with mm-hmm. building funds and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't figure out how that. I can. I mean, we all have it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I've discovered about Mormonism that fascinates me, because your friend Phil Barlow gave me some books to read, is that the Mormon deity, God, according to McMurrin, is material. And that to me was shocking, because most monotheisms in the West have an Aristotelian, we'll make it techie, a God who can't be touched or felt directly. It's not material substance. But I've looked back at both the Church and Judaism, and there were people who said God was material.
Mm-hmm.
But for students who are raised in a tradition to teach something about the past where you had a variance of opinions, I could see where, well, I know it's because I do it too. Mm-hmm. I get shock responses.
I wonder, this gets us into the whole question that you two professors are grappling with in terms of curriculum, is what is the goal? What should be taught? And one of those questions is, should we, speaking of religious matters, spiritual belief, should we teach it or should we teach about it? That's what you write this in an article, Professor Adler. I wonder if you could treat that question.
Oh, yeah, the question of teaching it or about it. I've heard that phrase from great teachers in every religion. I read it. I've been reading so much about Mormonism. Who said it? Oh, you know where it came up? One of our colleagues at Utah who comes to these breakfast meetings that we have, and this question is Bonnie Sloan Coffin.
Mm-hmm. Glass Coffin. Bonnie Glass Coffin. Yeah, Utah State.
Yeah, Utah State. Mm-hmm. These hyphenated names give me trouble. I'm sorry, Bonnie, if you're listening. She gave a brilliant – I had her present to the group on teaching difficult material to audiences that might have some trouble with it. So she taught a course in religion. Norm, why don't you tell us?
Well, she teaches a course in shamanism.
Okay.
And
you said it.
The shamanism is – I mean, she's been studying shamanism in Latin America for her entire career, and what she asked the students to do – is to participate in some of the rituals that are used by shamans. And so they all have what's called a mesa, and there are sacred objects on the mesa, and these are used to invoke spirits. And we have had students who have refused to take the class because it violated their beliefs. They believed that they were being invited into contact with Satan. And yet we have other students who adore the class because it rather than teaching about it, invited them into the experience. And this we're constantly wrestling with this question of how do you understand religion if you don't understand the experience of religion? You know, it's you can. Are you talking about just the stuffed animal, or are you going to see the moving animal?
Interesting.
And Bonnie told me that before she could teach that course, and she's so slight, but it seemed fascinating, that she had to get fire extinguishers, first of all, because they had a ceremonial fire, that it was approved because she was teaching about it. That is, she couldn't teach it itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference between the subjective and the objective. You can teach about it in the Mormon seminary, and we can teach about it at yeshiva in the rabbinical seminary, or what we call the morning studies. We our students segregate their day. They work 12 hours a day. In the morning, they take a very tough curriculum of Jewish studies, Bible, Gemara, you know, five layers of Jewish history in Hebrew and Aramaic, and they begin their secular classes in the afternoon. But they teach it in the morning, as one of our founders said, and they teach about it in the afternoon. They teach all traditions. I mean, I had a Hindu dancer come last week, and we teach about Hinduism. My current favorite topic is Mormonism, because that's what I'm studying. So that's the difference. And the question now is, higher education is very much into experiential education. That's one of the catchwords, right, Norm?
Mm-hmm.
So how can you experience religion without breaking down the church-state separation?
We're going to take a brief break.
Okay.
And when we come back, I'll try to pin Professor Adler down and see if he'll take a side, or maybe there's a middle way on teaching it or teaching about it. We'll bring in the culture wars. That's the atmosphere that which we're in which we're swimming, where these questions come to campus in a very loaded way because of that. And we'll talk about his other lecture as well that he'll be giving tomorrow, Are We Wired to Believe? And we are talking with Norman Adler from Yeshiva University and with Norm Jones from Utah State University. Professor Adler is in Logan tomorrow for two lectures that we've been mentioning. The first lecture, What Happens If Big Questions and College Collide? Faith and Reason on the American College Campus Today. That's what we've been talking about so far in the program. And that lecture is tomorrow, Wednesday, 11:30 in the morning, Library Room 101. The second lecture tomorrow is in the evening. Are We Wired to Believe? A biopsychologist looks at God and the brain, religion, and science. And that is tomorrow evening, 7 p.m., Old Main, room 225. More with Norman Adler and Norm Jones following a break.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Bonnie Plants, plant growers since 1918, dedicated to sharing a love of gardening to help people become successful and productive vegetable and herb gardeners. Information is at bonnieplants.com.
Are you deadline-driven, most productive as zero-hour approaches? Well, what about the ultimate end, the true end of the time frame? Deadline indeed. How does knowing that you're going to die affect your life? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're minding mortality. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday mornings at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
So we were talking before the break about this divide. Should we teach it, meaning religious belief? Should we teach about it? You mentioned, Norman Adler, that colleges are into experiential learning. So maybe that would lead you toward it. So which side do you take?
I'm a strict constructionist with respect to academics. I was dean and vice provost, and so I understand, I think, both sides. I think that the role of the professor, I'm not going to say the religious professor, but the professor, is to offer critical inquiry and the best of class of knowledge as it is today. That means this is introducing students to what has been thought, written, created in the past, and let them form their decision. So I try not to give the students any bias on my part. Now, sometimes it slips. I mean, I taught at the University of Pennsylvania for many years, and I was teaching, my field is actually neuroendocrinology, and I was lecturing about fetal development and reflexes, and I once talked about, how do you get these things, these babies to test? And I said, well, somebody committed an abortion. And they said, wait a minute, you're not supposed to have values. I said, what do you mean? And he said, he used the word committed, like committed murder. So I said, whoops. So that attitude just sort of, I don't like abortion, but I shouldn't have said that, so it just slipped out. With respect to religion, I don't endorse anyone. But I think that the professor, by elucidating what has been thought and developed, can provide a matrix from which the students can then explore their spirituality. And they can then go to a rabbi or to the to a ministry or to the campus chaplaincy or whatever organization is there, or to the Mormon seminary. We shouldn't make it difficult. And on the final exam, on my psychology and religion course, I train many future rabbis, so they're undergraduates, and I say, look, I teach you biochemistry, philosophy, theology. It's a very tough course, social science. And I say, one question is, if for those who are going to go into Jewish communal outreach, because Jewish kids like, with the exception of Mormons, I want to come back to Mormonism in a minute, leave the fold. We have a higher retention rate than Protestants do, but lower than Mormons. But they leave. And so I said, write a paper and tell me how to bring them back on the derech, it's called, on the way. And so using any technique from the course with bibliography and footnotes. So that's objective. And one wise guy in the class said to me, well, I should be able to take a religious student and kick him off the way and make him irreligious, and you have to give me an A. And I said, yeah, you're right, wise guy. I used a different word. But you better have enough references to back you up. But he was right. I would have to give him an A if he did that. Now, he was playing with me, and I was playing with him. But that's the role, I think, of the professor. I take it very seriously. We should not endorse. It'll give religion a bad name, especially. And that's, by the way, why I work in the scientific basis. That's why I give that second lecture. I'm not doing it for the sake of religion. There are priests and ministers and rabbis who can do that. I'm doing it for the sake of science, because I want science. I don't think they conflict, but I'm doing it to make science relevant, to make it interesting. We're working now on the neurobiology of consciousness. That's what Chalmers calls the big problem, the hard problem. The hardest problem is aesthetics, beauty, and God and religion. And that, I think, is the most interesting problem, and there's stuff that can be said about it. That's too much talking. I'm giving a lecture.
Very interesting, though. And I want to get into later in the program this question, are we wired to believe, and some of the latest research there and how you teach it. Let me turn to Professor Jones with this. Professor Adler did mention this whole debate at Harvard over the requirement, educational requirement, reason, and faith. But that was voted out, right? And some people said because it's too much faith, it's too much values in here. So speaking overall in the academy, where are we today on that?
Well, I think that Professor Adler is correct that there are a lot of faculty who are actually quite nervous. And one of the reasons about talking about religion, one of the reasons that they are nervous, there are two. One is that methodologically they don't feel that they've got a good handle on it because there's a kind of the evidentiary base is tricky when it comes to religion. But the other thing that I think concerns them, I hear this from our colleagues here, at what point does the faculty member feel that they must take a stand that is contrary to deeply held religious values? If you're a biologist, you really can't say to your students, well, you don't really have to believe in evolution and you can still be a biologist, because the whole basis of modern biology is evolutionary.
Yuck.
So, you know, that's...
I'm an evolutionary biologist.
But they, it makes them quite nervous, and so they have a tendency to not want that in the curriculum because they'd rather not have to deal with that issue.
Interesting. Could you follow up on your yuck, Professor?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, because I deal with that. I'm an evolutionary biologist. I'm an Orthodox Jew, and there's no problem with it, I think. I don't think that Mormons have a problem with it either. Evolution is primarily a problem for certain Baptists. The word fundamentalism was developed in this country in the 20s. I think there was a newspaper called The Fundamentals of Christianity. It's not intrinsically a problem for Catholicism because the last pope, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, and no, in fact, when he was pope, issued an encyclical. Not an encyclical. He wrote a paper when he went back to his university showing that faith and reason work together. I've given myself enough homework before the lecture to look up the paper.
Well, Thomas Aquinas said that too. So
yeah. Aquinas said it.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. And my mother said, it's never been a problem. I don't know what the Mormon position is. I'd have to ask Professor Barlow.
But to follow up on this.
And Judaism is not a problem. So I'll tell you what I do in class. I play with the most fundamentalist students, and I don't know if you can try this. Because I'm an evolutionary biologist, I published on evolution, and I say to them, did the Almighty, in Hebrew you say the Ribbono Shel Olam, ask you how he should create the world and by what mechanism? And they're shocked. And they said, of course not. That would be blasphemy of the highest order. I said, so what do you care what mechanism he used? Sit down and learn this stuff. If he used evolution, that's what he wanted to use. What difference does it make to you? And I said, and I have a theory of, I mean, it's sort of a play theory, but not really. The Lord God waited until, I think, by the way, religion is instinctive, until Neanderthal man got to a certain point, and then he revealed the Torah to us, and then if you believe, then Jesus came down. And then the Mormons believe that the angel Moroni gave the Book of Mormon to Joseph Smith, and the Lord God decided that our brains could evolve a little more because we were sort of, we're not doing it too well now, and waited for a century before the whole thing started. He would have given us the word not on the tablets on Mount Sinai, but he would have given it today on a silicon chip. But there'd still be fighting because there'd be some Android supporters of God and some Apple iPod supporters of God. So the fight will go on.
It sounds like you reconcile it. It sounds like you're comfortable with reconciling the two sides. But as you know, the culture wars are raging. It's raging on campus, and you know, a person like Richard Dawkins will say that anything you can't empirically verify or observe, we should reject. And there is a fair number of faculty, I imagine, which would subscribe
Absolutely.
to that belief
and
would
Richard
want to
Duffin's,
shape
We're in the
curriculum.
Same field. I've known him for 100 years. I mean, we were in Berkeley because we're in animal behavior. Richard is a, well, Norman knows this better than I. He is an empiricist, a positivist, not necessarily a logical positivist, a post-Enlightenment figure who believes only in verification by empirical observation. And I took him on in that article when he said, God is just another hypothesis that can be proved or disproved by empirical methods. And I refuted him by three quotations I said you may not cut out of this article. One was from the Pope, who said that faith and reason don't collide. Two was from the great philosopher Maimonides, who said that God is a hypothesis that cannot be tested because it's outside of reality. And the third was from that great philosopher Woody Allen. I guess I can do this in the air. It was in a movie. Who, when asked, because Dawkins says that God is not rational. It's not a rational concept. So when Woody Allen was asked, is sex dirty? Woody Allen answered, only if you do it right. So my answer, that's funny sort of. So my answer is, of course, religion isn't totally rational. If you want totally rational, you go to the lab, you know, dissect, flies or whatever you do. But if you want religion, it's rational plus something else.
So let me turn to Professor Jones, and we need to take a break. This raging culture war certainly is sort of the swirling atmosphere around this curriculum question that you and Professor Adler are trying to answer. I wonder if you could address that question. There would be probably a lot of faculty members who see an attack on science, and they would think we need to protect that. We need to lean more heavily in terms of empirical science.
I suspect that if they see it that way, it's because they don't know much about religion. But the culture war is exactly the reason why we need to have these conversations about the big questions, because as long as it's an irrational response on all sides, you're not going to make any progress. I mean, this is clearly important to our society to have this conversation, and one of our jobs is to figure out how you have the conversation safely and responsibly.
Let's take a break. We'll be back answering, and we'll turn to directly to this question of, are we wired to believe? We're talking with Norm Jones from Utah State University. He is history professor and founding director of the USU Religious Studies Program, and with Norman Adler, who is a biopsychologist and teaches at Yeshiva University in New York University. Professor Adler is in Logan tomorrow for two lectures for the Religious Studies program in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at USU. The evening lecture tomorrow evening is Are We Wired to Believe? A Biopsychologist Looks at God and the Brain, Religion, and Science. That is tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock in Old Main Room 225. Everyone is welcome. The other lecture preceding that earlier in the day is the one we've been talking about so far, What Happens If Big Questions and College Collide, Faith and Reason on the American College Campus Today. That lecture is 11:30 tomorrow morning, Library Room 101. More following the break.
Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
On the next On Being, acoustic biologist Katie Payne. She was among the first scientists to discover that whales are, as she says, composers of song. In recent years, she's decoded the language of elephants. We hear what she's learned about life in this world from two of its most mysterious creatures. I'm Krista Tippett. Please join me from APM.
Sunday evenings at 8 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're tackling some of the big questions. In fact, what happens if big questions and college collide? Faith and Reason on the American College campus today. And that is the topic of one of the lectures to be given tomorrow by Norman Adler, who is a biopsychologist teaching at Yeshiva University in New York City. That lecture is 11:30 tomorrow morning, Library Room 101. We're going to be talking in this next segment about some of the questions incident to the next lecture. That's in the evening, tomorrow evening. Are we wired to believe? A biopsychologist looks at God and the brain, religion, and science. That lecture is tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock in Old Main Room 225. These lectures are free and open to the public and presented by the USU Religious Studies Program and the USU College of Humanities and Social Sciences. We're talking with Norman Adler from Yeshiva University and Norm Jones from Utah State University. You're welcome to join this conversation at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or you can go online to our website, upr.org. And you can join us on Facebook. I'd like to jump into this question, Professor Adler.
Sure.
You study this, of course. Are we wired to believe? And you sent me an article written by Oliver Sacks, who you say does some of the best work in this. And it's some interesting work recently that he cites in this article, by the way, in the Atlantic Monthly, which gets us right into that nexus. Studying of, he calls it hallucinations, and he uses that word respectfully.
Yeah.
But for example, people who have epileptic seizures sometimes have ecstatic experiences,
yes,
that you could relate to,
yes,
religious experiences or out-of-body experiences or near-death,
yes,
experiences.
Right.
And you can, I guess you could explain this, in one sense you could explain this totally, could you, through biopsychology?
Well, the reason I think it's connected to the other questions is that it's at the core of the nexus between religious thought and the body. It's one of the classic problems. It's the mind-body problem, and it's even bigger because it's the God-mind-body problem. That's been, I think Norm would agree, it's, mm-hmm, that's sort of the classic problem that runs throughout all of our disciplines. Am I correct, Norman?
Oh, yes.
In fact, if I may, from an outsider, paraphrase Christianity, several of the heresies, or several in the early church, asked about the relation of God the Father to the rest of the Trinity and whether Jesus was body, part of God, and so on. I'm sure there were many more sects than I've read about. But basically, how do we perceive the divine? Part of it is of use to the study of religion, but part of it is of use, I think, to neuroscience, because that, I think, is one of the largest problems. Not all epileptics have visions, and not all people who have visions are epileptics. But the reason that it's interesting is that a part of the brain, and if you remind me, Norman, I will bring a model of the brain with me tomorrow.
Okay.
some of these seizures are in what's called the temporal lobe, where memory and emotion are coded. And I will refer you to a book that Norman knows called The Varieties of Religious Experience. And it was a book written by William James, who is the father of both psychology and philosophy in this country for me. I studied in William James Hall when I was an undergraduate. And in the first chapter, he talks to some young men, I think, at Princeton or Yale. He was at Harvard at the time. And he said, "You young men don't know who the Mahdi is, M-A-H-D-I. But for certain people, it's a life hypothesis. And you don't believe that St. Paul had a vision of Jesus on the road. Where's it? The road to Damascus, where he had the vision?
Yes.
Okay. Strictly from God, because that St. Paul was an epileptic. And it was an epileptic seizure that was, or a minor seizure that was causing it. Now, St. Paul may have had an epilepsy, and epileptics do sometimes have these visions. But James was so smart, he said, "Fine, I will grant you that St. Paul had epilepsy. Oh, and by the way, gentlemen, you are atheists because of the way your brain works. So they cancel out each other. I call that medical materialism. So let's get on with it. They cancel each other out and talk about the nature of belief."
Interesting.
And he founded the whole field that way. So we can sort of try to understand the nature of belief, but it doesn't say it's nothing but. That is, it's not the Dawkins approach. I'm sorry, Richard. It's not the approach that it's nothing but everything that we do is caused by it. Even Descartes, who was a firm Catholic, believed in God, tried to get a mechanism. He thought it was the pineal. But people don't know that Descartes used to go to the butcher shop and buy brains, sheep brains, to dissect them. So we've been doing this for a very long time, and trying to understand how we perceive things. There's something special about the temporal lobe. Yeah. Mm. I will show some slides of nuns who recall things, or Buddhist monks whose temporal lobes seem to fire more when they're in meditative states. But so what? Like I say to my students, God has to find a place in the brain for it, so why not put it there? Your job, students, is to figure out why the temporal lobe is involved.
You have some people who have these experiences who become religious afterwards, and some who have these experiences and were religious and are no longer religious.
I mean, after the seizures.
After the seizures or whatever experience.
It's not a one correlation. Some people don't like the new fMRI techniques because they call it phrenology. You know, the old technique where people would feel your skull for bumps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people laugh at that, but that was actually the beginnings of modern neuroscience or neurology. All that this stuff tells you is something is going on there. And if a lot of different things go on there, you can see what's correlated. So memory and emotion go on there, and sometimes you can localize it even more. But there are at least 100 billion, maybe 400 billion neurons in the brain. That's individual nerve cells. Each one could have 1,000 connections. So I'll take an average number. 200 billion times 1,000 connections is, I don't know, a trillion pieces of information or possible combinations. Pretty complex.
Now, you study this, you know, closely, and you are religious, so you're at an interesting intersection there. I wonder if you could expand on that. You believed, despite what we can obviously see happening in the brain with some of these experiences, which you might correlate with religious experiences, you believe there's something else. There's soul beyond the brain. There's something else. There's a mystery there.
That one I haven't figured out. I don't want to be a dualist. Jews don't like being, you know, a dualist is somebody who believes in two things, like mind-body, soul-body. I'd rather be a monist and think there's only one thing. But there's a guy, Salov at Princeton. I'm sort of a modified monist. I don't like sloppiness and don't want to have to be, accept two things. But yes, I don't believe in it in spite of that. I believe in it partly because of that. I heard Oliver Sacks speak a few weeks ago. I got him to autograph my book, Hallucinations. And I was really disappointed when I heard him because he's getting up there in years, all of us are. And somebody said, "Okay, now that you're approaching, you know, the other, well, whatever he's approaching, I don't know. He should live to 120. It's a Jewish blessing." Do you believe? He says, "No. I hope for a few more good years, and then I'll pack it in. I believe in the beauty of science. I believe in music, but no." I said, "No, come on, pack to our team." I think he's Jewish. I don't care. It could be whatever, Chair Delfwagen. But I wanted to come back. And my rabbi said, "Don't be so arrogant. You know, he can believe whatever he wants to believe." But I sort of got religious when I was like 17, worked for this Quaker biology teacher who gave me a slide of cells. I looked at it. And I said, "Oh, my God, there's got to be a reason for this." No, I had gone to Hebrew school and so on. It's an emotional response. I accept the Kierkegaardian notion of a leap of faith. I don't think you can do without that, because if you believe in a system, there is probably more than reason that will get you there. It has to be a leap. You know, it doesn't have to be an existential leap, but there is something. I only know of one person, he's on the faculty here, who is a logician, David Johnson. He's brilliant. He writes in a weird language called symbolic logic. He says he can prove the existence of God, but he's the only one.
And this will, despite the advances in science, and it's getting very interesting with this brain science, in your view, this will, the two sides will not come together unless you can reconcile it. You can't prove it through science or disprove it.
I don't think you can ever prove it. I mean, Norman can. I mean, even the particular philosopher in my tradition is Maimonides. He's like Aquinas. He's an Aristotelian with a bit of Neoplatonism thrown in. Mm. And on one issue, the creation of the world, he differed from Aristotle because Aristotle said that the world has always existed. That's creation ex nihilo. And he said, "No, But he admitted in one part of his Guide to the Perplexed that, you know, on strictly rational grounds, I can't decide between the two of them. So you have to go back to the Bible. So I'm not sure that commitment to an institutionalized religion can ever be approached. But who knows? I don't know. Remember, Aquinas did have four proofs for the existence of God. The rationalists try to, but I don't know in the modern age. What about the two of you? I mean, either Tom or Norm.
Let me jump in on this because I've got a maybe. This feels to me like a more profound question, but maybe it's not. As a historian, I'm very, very aware of the evolution of ways of knowing, not necessarily the evolution of the brain, but the evolution of intellectual fashion. And I do wonder sometimes if the kind of research that you're doing maybe is pushing us into a post-Enlightenment kind of a conversation, because the blurring of the rational distinctions, you know, between the life sciences and physical sciences and theology and aesthetics and all these sorts of things, but we're all of us working across those lines. And I sometimes wonder if you know, it's the tools are not yet sharp enough. Maybe in the future there might be a different set of tools that might bring us to a different answer. But I do agree that currently the systems that we have are not good enough to ever say, now we've settled this.
Mm-hmm. Professor Adler, your response to that, we'll have to close with this. We're running out of time.
I don't think it's like, was it the Heisenberg principle? Mm-hmm. I don't think... or Gödel's proof, I don't think that from within the rational system we'll ever be able to ultimately prove it. You said the tools aren't ready yet. Well, the historian's tools are about as developed as they can be. I mean, they change schools. Scientists' new tools can be developed. But I think it's the philosopher who will have to examine the tools. I can't see a religion without fun, or what Rudolf Otto called the numinous or the awe. If you don't have that... If it ain't got that swing, or whatever that old tune was, it doesn't work. So I don't see how from the academy we can jump into it. But if I'm proved wrong, that's great.
We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Our thanks to Norm Jones, professor at Utah State University. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Professor Norman Adler from Yeshiva University. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
And you can hear more about these subjects at two lectures that Professor Norman Adler from Yeshiva University is going to give tomorrow on the Utah State University campus. He's being brought in by the Religious Studies Program and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at USU. The evening lecture, Are We Wired to Believe? A Biopsychologist Looks at God and the Brain, Religion, and Science. That is tomorrow evening on the USU campus, Old Main, Room 225. Preceding that, tomorrow morning, is a lecture called What Happens If Big Questions and College Collide? Faith and Reason on the American College Campus. Today, that lecture, 11:30, tomorrow morning, Library Room 101. My thanks to Professors Norm Jones and Norman Adler. We have with us tomorrow one of the co-authors of a very provocative book, which was published in 2012. It's even worse than it looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with a New Politics of Extremism. Norm Ornstein is my guest tomorrow. We'll talk about the asymmetry in political extremism. The authors place more of the blame on the Republicans. We'll talk about why some of their solutions are very provocative as well, including mandatory attendance at the polls. It's even worse than it looks, Norm Ornstein, tomorrow on the program. For producers Danny Hayes, Lindsay Snyder, and Addison Pace, I'm Tom Williams. Thanks for listening.